And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
You know, I think your brain produces a chemical that blocks out my voice.
What?
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara Counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is potpourri. Each of my guests is discussing an interesting subject, no two of which are related. My next guest is our husband and wife team of futurists. We'll tap into their expertise in technology and look at which technologies will be the most important to us in the future, and we'll determine if social media is here to stay. If you want to join in the conversation or if you have a question, you can always call us at 639-0008. Jared Wiener is Vice President of Wiener, Erdick & Brown, one of the world's leading future consulting firms. Jared is integrally involved in the identification and understanding of emerging trends in the global marketplace. Jared has a dual BA in psychology and political science from the University of Rochester and an MBA from the Simon Graduate School of Business at the University of Rochester. Erica Orange is also a Vice President at Wiener, Erdick & Brown, LLC. She has authored several articles on various social, technological, economic, and political trends. She received her BA in political science and psychology from the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York. Joining us from New York City, Erica and Jared, how are you both today?
We're great, Bill. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, well, thank you for having us.
Thank you for being my guest. I love to talk to subject matter experts, particularly when it comes to technology, because technology is ever-changing, and it's hard for us, as we're living in the day-to-day world, to really get a view, an overview of technology. So I'm going to take a step backwards, if I can, and start with the 20th century, because at the beginning of the 20th century, we saw a whole bunch of widespread societal changes, technology that came on board. We saw the electrification of homes and businesses, the automobile really became popular, telephone became popular, radio, photography, all of that stuff. Interestingly, that most of these technologies were discovered 20 or 30 years prior to their adoption in the beginning of the 20th century. So what technologies that were invented in the 1980s are we seeing come to fruition here in the 2010s?
Well, I mean, the best example of this sort of delay that you've pointed out historically is really the advent of what we see today with the internet, all of its related technology, social media. I mean, this all began with the DARPANET decades ago. And, you know, the Department of Defense and a lot of military applications are really the forerunner for a lot of the technology that ends up becoming commonplace. And so the DARPANET was something that was being worked on a long, long time ago, and it eventually became the mass-consumed internet and then sort of Internet 2.0 and beyond that we see today. So everything that we see happening today, all of the rapid pace of technological change, it's all coming off of the internet, had its seed decades ago, and it took until the mid to late 1990s for it to really take hold.
Well, now, are we seeing the commercialization rate of technology happening at a faster pace than ever before?
Absolutely. It not only is the pace of change increasing rapidly, but what we like to say is that there are fewer barriers to entry into the marketplace now. So technology is becoming more ubiquitous. It is more quickly becoming commoditized. It's a lot easier for an individual or a small group of people with the right set of skills to, you know, programmers, designers, developers to come in and play in this space. Now, that's not to say that they're all going to be successful. Obviously, only the strong will survive. But realistically, these are becoming commercialized a lot more quickly and a lot more easily than ever before.
Well, that brings up an interesting point, and you just pointed that out yourself, and that is that there's going to be a higher failure rate for some of these smaller businesses. Yes, granted, the barriers to entry are lower from a technological standpoint, but here we are at the beginning of the 21st century facing an even bigger barrier to entry than technology, and that is the barrier of lack of capital. I mean, yes, there might be some wonderful ideas that are percolating out there today, which may never see the light of day simply because they can't find the money to fund them.
I think that'll be true with some technologies, but as we're seeing too, especially as more technologies become democratized, a lot more people have access to them. So we'll look at one example. Let's use cloud computing, for example. And the ability for small businesses to really compete with some of the big boys out there through the cloud and through some of these more like leveling technologies will change the playing field in a lot of ways, not only in terms of the commercialization of products, but also in terms of companies out there in the marketplace.
Yeah, and crowdsourced fundraising platforms that are available online. These are proliferating at a rapid rate, and Essentially what that means is these are websites or web portals or widgets that allow the average person out there to contribute money towards a startup venture, a new business. These are allowing, again, for the democratization of financing of some of these new businesses. So access to capital is not as limited as it was before. And we recently talked to our clients about this equation of valuation versus value of a lot of these best-of-breed technology companies. It used to be that to start a business and to run a business successfully was very, very labor-intensive, very capital-intensive. You know, GM at one point employed 600,000 people.
Yes.
Facebook employs about 2,000 and reaches an audience of 500 million people, and they don't even have to go to the public markets to raise money. So the entire paradigm has changed.
Well, Facebook is its own paradigm in and of itself. What is it valued at? $50 billion today, and it hasn't even become a public company?
Right, that's exactly
right. Yeah, something
insane,
yeah.
So the model is completely shifted. So not only are technologies changing rapidly, but the way that the companies who run those technologies are doing business has really changed the way that we even think about capitalism and job creation and all of that fun stuff.
I want to return back to what you said about crowdsourced fundraising portals that are out there. Yes, we all know that they exist. I'm going to ask you for a couple of names, but I'm also going to ask you, do they really have the large sums of money to invest? Because it's, you know, mom and pop, here's $1,000 here, $1,000 there. But if I want to start the next General Motors, and I'm using that as a really bad example, but if I wanted to start something of that scale, I'm going to need hundreds of thousands of dollars, not just thousands or tens of thousands of dollars. So give us some names, and do they really have access to the larger sums of capital that big companies need?
Well, when you talk about crowdsource platforms, I mean, one of the big ones that people are starting to hear a lot about is called Kickstarter. Facebook has an application which ties into this sort of crowdsourced fundraising model. You know, but going beyond crowdsourced fundraising, we also need to think about what's happening in the private equity space. You know, a lot of these businesses are going around the stock exchange. They're going around public markets. In fact, listings on the American Stock Exchange have decreased dramatically over the last, couple of decades. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that these technology startups are accessing large amounts of private equity money from small groups of investors. So middle-class investors, the average Joe out there who wants to get a piece of these companies is being shut out. So in a lot of cases, you're seeing three or four primary investors with a lot of money ponying up the kind of cash that you just mentioned to get these businesses off the ground. So the concentration of wealth off of these businesses is pretty tremendous.
Well, a Blackstone...
Well, I mean, you look at some of these examples, and they're so in their infancy. As we look at other iterations that are likely to come after, you know, we'll see them be a little less issues-based and a little more geared towards providing mass sums of capital to the larger organizations. You know, they started as very grassroots, but we'll see them developing more and more to encompass more people and more sums of money in the future.
Very good. My guests are Jared Wiener and Erica Orange of Wiener, Erdrick & Brown, LLC. We're talking about technology. I'm going to change gears if I can for just a bit because this is topical. And, Jared, you mentioned it in one of your earlier answers about military technology becoming commercialized and jumping into space. And certainly war speeds up the development and the deployment of technology, things like airplanes, medicine, GPS is a great outshoot of the Gulf War 1991. While we have not had a worldwide war in the beginning of the 21st century like we did at the beginning of the 20th century, there's a new threat emerging, the threat of cyber war. And there have been recent cyber attacks that if you've been paying attention to the news that have been attacking both businesses and government. And they include the French Ministry of Finance, Sony, Lockheed Martin, which is a defense contractor, Citibank, the International Monetary Fund, and even the CIA. I mean, you'd think that they would have some security at the CIA. So, you know, will the wars of the future be fought in cyberspace is my first question. And what are some of the risks of a cyber war?
Well, you know, that's a great question. There are a lot of ways to answer that. I mean, first and foremost, the Pentagon recently identified cyber warfare as really the fifth horizon or the fifth sort of landscape for combat. I mean, obviously land, air, sea, space, and now cyber warfare. So the Pentagon has identified that that's going to be really part of the future of warfare. It's already starting to happen. And, you know, the interesting thing about this is that in many of the cases where we've already seen, attacks play out, we have individuals executing them, but then they get blamed back on governments or regimes. We have potentially have regimes behind them, sort of state-sponsored examples of this where, you know, then it becomes, you know, the situation where they blame it back on an individual or a rogue. You have a lot of mutual accountability and blame taking place. This space is still very amorphous, very hard to triangulate what the source of the problem is in many cases. But this is very much the future of warfare.
All right.
It ties together with the whole issue of, the, you know, growing military technology, you know, drone warfare, what it's going to look like to have remotely controlled bots and drones, you know, execute attacks where humans used to have to do so. Basically, every aspect of warfare, whether it's cyber warfare, drone warfare, you name it, in the future is going to remove elements of human accountability from the equation. And that could be a very dangerous place to play.
Interesting. Removing the human accountability. Now, recently I had Jeffrey Deaver, the novelist, as a guest on my show. He talked about a terrorist attack against a power grid. And to me, that's where cyber war would have its most devastating effects. Attack our power grid here in the United States, attack our financial institutions like they tried to do with Citibank, even attack the health industry. You know, if you debilitated all of the health records in the United States or even some of them in a major city, that could be a devastating blow, too. So what are some of the other risks that we face besides the disconnect between humans and warfare? What are some of the other risks that are out there?
It's really about the infrastructure, as you just mentioned, the interconnectivity of the infrastructure and in some cases how antiquated many of the grids are leads to vulnerability in this area. And so if you think about it domestically, we talk about all of our trends on a global scale, but there are times where we like to bring it home at least to illustrate a point to a domestic level. You think about the challenges the U.S. faces right now as far as the antiquated nature of a lot of the infrastructure, and this is one of the problems. Everything is so interconnected that literally one individual with a sophisticated toolkit at their disposal can do damage in the way that we're talking about. So this is obviously something which the government, which the military has identified as a risk area, as a vulnerability. And, you know, this extends to our understanding of systems in general. All the technology out there, when we think about corporate systems and the cloud, you know, you can have someone very highly specialized come in and design your technical systems. And if that person leaves and they take their intellectual capital with them, oftentimes the people that follow have a hard time disentangling you know, the grids and the technology systems, and it becomes an ongoing issue. So that's what we face on a macro scale now, and it certainly is going to be one of the new horizons of warfare.
My guests are Jared Wiener and Erica Orange of Wiener, Ehrlich & Brown, LLC. We're talking about the future. And, Jared, in that last answer, you brought up a very interesting point about disgruntled people or even cyber terrorists. Could a cyber terrorist or a disgruntled employee plunge the world into a real war, a physical war, in the same way that a Serbian terrorist thrust the world into World War I?
Yeah, I mean, I go back, Bill, to what I was saying about the democratization of technology. When we have so much now at our disposal, it elevates the role of the individual, where it used to be a group of people would have to organize to really wage a mass war and affect a lot of people. Now the individual has that power, and I go back to what Jared says. As systems are connecting with other systems and networks and robots and all of these, we call them quote-unquote non-carbon life forms, that really control a lot of our actions and like the day-to-day operations, again, it puts a lot of control in the hand of that individual and the systems that they are interfacing with.
Well, it brings up an interesting point, and I want to hearken back, and then we'll get off of this subject, but I want to hearken back to the attack that Russia placed on Chechnya. Now, the Russians said that that was just a bunch of disgruntled people attacking Chechnya, but Russia and Chechnya have been in a long-standing war, and there is real strong belief, even among our own U.S. State Department, that it was government-sanctioned terrorism, even though it was perpetrated by one or two individuals. Are we going to see more and more of these kinds of attacks in the future?
Yeah, sure you will.
Exactly.
But as I mentioned before, the tricky part of this whole equation is it will be very hard to prove or triangulate whether something is coming from an individual or a rogue group of individuals or if it's state-sponsored, because there is this shifting gray area and mutual accountability and blame that we've already seen develop. And you could think of scenarios where someone who works for a government, is a government worker, and has access to a lot of information, has technical skills, could, you know, infiltrate something like this and then blame it back to the state. So I think that one of the critical issues going forward is going to be for governments to be able to identify, is this something that we have to take action on a macro scale, or is this basically a patch or a security flaw that's been exposed by one or two really sophisticated individuals? There's no easy answer for that. And I think that all of the governments around the world are going to have to wrestle with that issue. We've already seen accusations lobbied at China on occasion. North Korea has been implicated in some issues that the United States has had as far as potential attacks on our grids. But we don't know for sure where those are coming from.
Oh, good. It just brings out the whole need for cybersecurity. Is cybersecurity going to be one of those positions, one of those jobs that in the future is only going to gain in importance? Is that where kids coming out of college today should be looking for their longer-term employment, cybersecurity?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think our understanding of cybersecurity is so much in its infancy that it will undoubtedly be a growing field. And for a lot of the kids coming out of college who might understand this world and have interfaced with this world from the time that they were pretty much out of the womb, their understanding of how these systems and networks operate, they may be at an advantage when it comes to that.
All right. My guests are Jared Wiener and Erica Orange. We're talking about technology, and I'm going to shift gears one more time and change to something that I teased the audience about, and that is social media. Social media right now, it's the rage in everyday life. You know, mothers 50 years old are keeping up with their grandchildren and their children on Facebook. It's also the rage in business today. While social media is interesting, is it a lasting trend or is it merely a fad?
I wouldn't say that it's necessarily a fad. But again, I think we'll see several iterations as we move through not only this internet, but other internets to come. What I think is here to stay is the connections, the web that we're really developing of people-to-people interactions online. The way in which we communicate is obviously shifting tremendously. And I think we'll see a lot more moving into this space mm-hmm. than ever before. And I 100% believe that that will continue.
Yeah, social media is certainly here to stay. It will evolve very quickly, and it's always very hard to predict or project what the next stages of that evolution will look like. But as I mentioned before, because of the lower barriers to entry in many ways, at least technological barriers to entry, you're going to see an increasing number of players in every aspect of this space. The strong will survive, and they will redefine the space. But what you end up seeing at the end of the day is what we call a growing narcissism. And narcissism has a negative connotation, but it's really the democratization of voices online and the ability for each person out there now to have a voice, to want to be heard, to want the focus put on themselves. The blogosphere is very crowded. That's going to continue. So I certainly think this is here to stay, but it morphs every few years.
The other thing for young people now, their virtual possessions are far more important to them than their actual physical possessions. That we're really seeing that shift occur in terms of valuing their online pictures, their online content. So I don't think that that's going anywhere in the near future either.
It may not. My guests have been Jared Wiener and Erica Orange, a husband and wife team of futurists. Guys, if people are intrigued by what you have to say, they want to learn more about you, learn more about your writings, where would you direct them to go?
Definitely check out our website, wieneredrichbrown.com. We have a blog on there with a lot of great stuff. We also are frequent contributors on Twitter, so you can follow our Twitter handle, WEB Future Trends. I'm at ER Orange, and Jared is at J Wiener Web.
Yes, and that's Wiener Edrich, E-D-R-I-C-H, Brown. Wiener spelled like Anthony Wiener, but no relation to him.
Very good. Jared, Erica, thank you so much for being my special guest. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you very much.
Excellent.
Bill.
Take care.
Thanks, Bill.